Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ted Dixon, CEO and co-founder of InkResearch.ca, Canada's first online financial news and research service, providing insider news and knowledge to investors. His website, CanadianInsider.com, home of the Canadian Insider Club. Welcome back to the show, Ted.
Jim, thanks for having me back, and thanks for everyone listening in.
Can we talk about the International Monetary Fund's warning on U.S. deficits and recent CEO selling at J.P. Morgan?
Yeah, I think that's a couple of big news items that maybe have escaped attention here in Canada because of the federal budget. But, yes, Canada has a bit of a deficit problem, but it's nothing in comparison to what's going on south of the border. And just this week, we had the IMF come out and warn about the situation facing the United States. Basically, the IMF Research Department Director Pierre-Olivier Gornichas said, pretty bluntly, in the United States, the fiscal stance is out of line with long-term fiscal sustainability. This raises short-term risks of the deflation process, meaning we could be in for another bout of inflation, as well as long-term fiscal and financial stability risks for the global economy. In other words, the IMF is concerned that the U.S. is going to bring the global economy down with its runaway deficits. I mean, that's basically what they're saying. And he goes on to say, fiscal consolidations are never easy, but it's best not to wait until markets dictate their conditions. Well, Jim, you and I know that politicians hardly ever act proactively. They always decide to close the barn door after the horse is well down the road, out of the barnyard. So this is a big issue, and it's going to provide investors with a lot of volatility in the months and weeks ahead. The IMF is concerned, and it's a big issue. And when you combine that with what we've seen happen in the banking sector in the United States, and I'm focused on the United States, and this is what we highlighted in our U.S. report, which we published on April 17th. It's available, by the way, on insidertracking.com. That's our site that focuses primarily focuses more on the U.S. We do have Canadian filings on there. But if you go to insidertracking.com, it's also our least expensive site. You can pick out a monthly membership there, pretty low. But in the April 17th report, we noted that Jamie Dimon, CEO of J.P. Morgan, just this week sold just almost $32 million worth of stock. And, you know, that isn't the first time he's been selling. Over the past 90 days, he sold, by our accounts, just under $183 million worth of shares. This is the CEO, the biggest, most important money center bank in the United States, if not the world, because as we know, whenever there's a problem in the United States, the Fed and Washington go to J.P. Morgan to basically bail out whoever needs the help or to provide the assistance that's necessary. So this is a very big event, I think, on the insider side that Jamie Dimon, who was buying during the global financial crisis. I was there. We were running Inc. Inc. was up and going 2008. We lived through it all. Jamie Dimon buying during the financial crisis. Okay. Well, now he's taken money off the table. He's taken some profits off of that great trade. And you know, I think he's trying to send Americans a signal, you know, like, I'm taking money off the table here. Do what you want, but I'm taking money off the table here. What do I know? I'm only the CEO of the most important money center bank in the world, but what do I know, right? And so this is to put the JP Morgan stock down our rankings, and I also think it gives us a very big signal of caution as we contemplate IMF's concerns about U.S. fiscal sustainability. So we're definitely downbeat in terms of insider signals on the U.S. market. Our U.S. indicator is below 30%. That means there's basically less than 3 stocks with key insider buying for every 10 with selling. Yes, insiders are early. Usually they tend to move early, but this has now been in place for some time. And, you know, I think it's, you're basically, if, you know, there's always the wall of worry. You know, we keep hearing that, well, you got to be in stocks and they're always going to go up and they just climb the wall of worry. Well, as we know, they don't always go up. And right now there seems to be some resistance ahead. And that's at least what insiders are telling us. The JP Morgan CEO is taking money off the table in the U.S. market. So, use that information accordingly. But we're a lot more constructive in terms of the Canadian market, which is a completely different type of market than the U.S. market. The U.S. market, broad, it's industrial, it's tech. I mean, it's innovation. It's all the things when the economy is booming, when things are great, or even when the economy is doing okay. You know, when you've got the U.S. firing on all cylinders, it's not artificial. That you've got, you know, the U.S. economy is allowed to do what it does best, and that is create wealth. When it's allowed to do that, and the government doesn't get in the way, and you don't have wars, you don't have big deficits, and the U.S. government isn't spending $1 trillion or more a year on interest, which is what they're doing now, the U.S. economy and U.S. market is the place to be. But, unfortunately, we've got an interventionist Trudeau-like government in the U.S., the Biden administration, that's increasing the role of government in the U.S. Interest payments are now going to be more than U.S. interest payments. I saw something, the calculation today is going to be between 2 and 3% of GDP just to pay the interest on the U.S. debt. These are significant headwinds, even for the U.S., the great U.S. economy, and, you know, that's been leading the world in innovation. They're now sort of, unfortunately, they've kind of taken a page out of the Canadian book and have gone way, I think, overboard on government intervention in the economy, and now they're going to face some of the challenges that Canadians are all too familiar with.
What's going to happen with gold?
Well, gold's been hitting new all-time highs, right? And this has confounded Wall Street, right? Because it's like, well, real interest rates are so high and bond yields are so high. Why is gold doing so well? Well, I think you have to look at geopolitics, the geopolitical situation. That's, you know, the other side of, you know, not the other side, but another factor here. We just talked about the U.S. federal deficits, which are increasing the risk of some sort of monetization of the debt, some sort of confiscation of capital. It would be probably by a very sneaky way, but some sort of sophisticated confiscation of capital to finance those deficits in the U.S. This has got, between the U.S. fiscal situation that's been building and the geopolitical situation, which is now at reaching sort of generational turning points, I think, gold is getting a bid. So, but Wall Street certainly does not want to talk about it. They may mention it in passing. Oh yeah, gold hit a new all-time high now. Let's talk about NVIDIA. You know, it's signaling something here, and I think it's both the U.S. fiscal situation and also the geopolitical situation in the world. So it's got two major tailwinds behind it right now.
Well, right now the Middle East conflict is leading to more sanctions against Iran. But you pointed out something very important, that the hyper use of sanctions are now pushing Iran, Russia, and China closer together.
Well, Drake, this is the biggest unintended consequence of the sanctions. And because, you know, I don't for a moment believe that all the bureaucrats in the U.S. Treasury and the EU wanted to come up with policies that would push Russia, China, and Iran together. I don't think that was the outcome they were looking for, but that is the outcome they are getting because of this over-reliance on sanctions on, you know, now, you know, we have this this dangerous tit-for-tat between Iran and Israel right now, and the U.S. has now announced today they're going to do more sanctions. Now, if this is a way to stop the bombing between the two countries, that's fine. You know, that would be a good use of sanctions. Okay? But it is just one of many of the streaming use of sanctions. And, you know, they're putting sanctions back on Venezuela. You know, it just never ends. And, you know, I kind of think, you know, look, the U.S. is the head chef in the developed world kitchen. And, you know, if they're going to use the hot sauce, they should use it sparingly, right? You know, and not to put it on every little dish that comes their way that they feel they have to deal with. You know, let's use these sanctions in a targeted way when they're really necessary. Because to be honest with you, I don't know, Jim, there's been so many sanctions. Have any of them actually worked? You know, I can't think of a successful outcome, certainly under the Biden administration, with these multiple sanctions that they've put on different countries. I mean, I don't see a good outcome evolving in the Russia-Ukraine war for the NATO bloc. I see that kind of Russia has some momentum there. And as you mentioned, you know, now we see Russia, China, and Iran cooperating more and more. And this is also going to likely lead to a major alternative being presented at the BRICS summit in October, when the BRICS meet, the BRICS leaders meet in Kazan, Russia, where we expect that there's a very good chance that Russia will unveil to the group an alternative payment system that will allow BRICS countries to not use the current SWIFT system, which is the one that, you know, that basically all the NATO bloc uses, and, well, basically everyone uses, but it's basically controlled by the NATO bloc, by the U.S. and the EU primarily. And there's going to be an alternative to that. And this likely would not have happened, or would not be in the process, as it hasn't happened yet. It's not an easy thing to do. You don't just build a payment system that can be used by multiple countries overnight. But this motion to, like, this momentum to build an alternative system to the SWIFT system likely would not have had the momentum that it does without all these sanctions. So, you know, this is a key development that we'll need to watch over the summer and into the fall. And Russia, I think, is very determined to build this. It's unclear at this point what role gold would play in that system. You know, look, I keep hearing from a certain crowd in the financial community, oh, you know, the renminbi is never going to challenge the dollar. The renminbi is never going to challenge the dollar. Well, it probably won't challenge the dollar in my lifetime, but that's not the issue. The issue is the payment system, and whether there's an alternative payment system that evolves to challenge the dollar-based payments. And the key characteristic, Jim, and this is what I have to stress here, and the most important element of this system that Russia is working on, is that I believe, from what I understand, the key characteristic of the system, it will allow countries to use their own local currency. So all this talk we heard, all this hype we heard about, oh, a BRICS currency last year and a BRICS currency this, and oh, the BRICS currency isn't going to happen and the BRICS currency is going to happen. No, that made for good newsletter and a few newspaper articles. That's not what's the Russians are working on. The Russians, from what I understand, are working on a payment system that will allow countries to use their own currencies to do transactions between countries. And there is some thinking that commodities and gold will play a role in that settlement layer. Now, we'll have to wait and see. We'll just have to wait and see how that transpires. But that's coming in October. I believe it's October 22nd. And, you know, we'll probably hear more about that if it's going to happen. It's not a slam dunk. It's very, you know, it's very difficult to develop that kind of a framework, but it's interesting. The Russians are leading it. The Chinese, I don't think, could lead it because, look, it's BRICS. They've got to get India on board, right? Very difficult if China's leading it. So this whole talk you hear about the renminbi versus the dollar, that's not the contest that's happening that's going to matter. It's whether Russia can deliver this alternative payment system to the BRICS coming up in October, and that would be a game changer.
Well, I can see China and Russia's fascination with gold. Their central banks have been stocking up on gold now, I think, the last 12 years. Nazi Germany in the 1930s, the Deutsche Mark was worthless outside of Germany, and they had to make all of their payments in gold. So if you have sanctions and they're not taking your currency and so on, if you have gold, no one ever says no to gold.
Right, and if you can back up the U.S. dollar used to be backed up by gold, right? And they took it off when it suited them in the 1970s. And, you know, that's why I have to feel that if this payment system is going to work, there'll have to be some sort of a commodity component to it. I mean, what's also interesting, too, is that oil is benefiting again from these geopolitical tensions, because especially with the Middle East involved, but also because it's Russia and Ukraine, you know, Russia being an energy exporter. You know, there's an incentive for players in the global market to hoard some oil. If you see these inventory numbers come out every week, and, you know, you get some of these headlines every Tuesday and Wednesday about inventories, don't be surprised if some countries want to actually increase their inventories just to make sure they have enough on hand. And so as we've had these geopolitical risks rise this year, you know, the Inc. Canadian Insider Index, which is 50 stocks preferred by insiders listed on the TSX, it has outperformed. It's been outperforming the S&P 500. And, you know, it's up as of the 17th of April, it's up 10% so far in 2024. And this, we saw this happen the year that Russia invaded Ukraine. It also outperformed in 2022. So 2023... you may remember that there was a lot of excitement that Ukraine had launched a counterattack. They threw out the Russians from the areas around Kharkiv. And there was a lot of excitement in the fall of 2023 that there would be a Ukrainian big counteroffensive this summer, last summer. There, in the fall of 2022, there was some excitement building that there would be a Ukraine counteroffensive in the summer of 2023. But it seems that the fall of 2022 was sort of the high water mark of the Ukraine counterattack. And that was also, by the way, when the NASDAQ started to rally. But we had all this hope going into 2023 that at the very worst, you would have a stalemate in Ukraine. But I think that is now wishful thinking. We now see the Russians with some momentum. The geopolitical risks are rising there. This is looking like it could be, from what I understand, I'm not a military expert, so there will be people who disagree with me on it, and that's fair enough because I'm not a military aficionado by any stretch. But the Russians seem to have some military momentum now in Ukraine, which raises the prospect of a potential NATO-like defeat, because we've been supporting Ukraine. So this will be interesting to see how it plays out. Look, you know, things ebb and flow in battles all the time. Maybe there will be a change of fortunes for Ukraine in the weeks and months ahead. That's all possible. But right now, it's not looking so good. And then we've got this problem, of course, in the Middle East, where we've got massive escalation between Iran and Israel, which is not a very good situation for global investors, global investing is best done during times of peace, not during times of conflict, major conflict. So now is a very edgy time. But look, the Canadian market, because of its exposure to resources, to oil and gas, to gold and silver and copper, Canadian market is offering opportunity now, not just because of geopolitics, because we can hope and we can pray that this all gets resolved in a peaceful way and that we can move on. But then you get to the whole issue of the not just the energy transition, which has kind of been forgotten in all of this, and you've got this boom in AI, which we kept hearing about, and if this boom in AI gains some traction, then you're going to have more data centers, and they're going to need massive amounts of energy to fuel power server farms to hold to power these NVIDIA chips that everybody was excited about. And to build server farms, you need electricity, you need uranium to power nuclear reactors, you need copper to go into these server farms. So the peacetime outlook for the Canadian market is pretty good. Never mind the geopolitics, which we're benefiting from right now, as I would argue, a hedge against some of the more problematic outcomes associated with these conflicts. But let's hope that our leaders can come up with some solutions here to bring the Ukraine conflict down to a resolution, and that we enter into a more peaceful situation in the Middle East as soon as possible. Then we can get back to building, focusing on the role that copper plays in the AI boom, and whether the role that copper plays in the energy transition, and gold and silver will still be in the spotlight as the U.S. deals with its fiscal situation, which will not get any attention until 2025 at the earliest, until we get through the elections in the fall.
Canada doesn't hold any gold at all. 88 countries in the world don't have any gold at all. Our gold was sold off through the 1990s and into early 2000. What was the strategy there?
Jim, I'm happy to report that Canada has a lot of gold. It just happens to be in the ground, and it's up to our junior miners to go and get it. And so the fact that the Bank of Canada, which runs its reserves like a giant hedge fund, doesn't have any gold doesn't surprise me, but I'm more excited about the role that our junior mining players can play in making sure that a lot of Canada's reserves under the ground come to the surface. So I'm quite bullish about that.
So they don't need it in the bank. It's in the ground, and they own the ground so far.
British Columbia, the people of British Columbia own the reserves under the ground. We've got to have the business environment that allows junior miners to go and get that gold and bring it out of the ground so that taxpayers and citizens can benefit from the royalties associated with that. So I'm not worried about Canada, the Bank of Canada, not having gold on its balance sheet. I'm worried about the Bank of Canada, but I'm not worried about the fact that it doesn't have any gold, because the Bank of Canada has bigger problems than not having any gold. That's a whole different story. But I think you have to be realistic that we have lots of gold in Canada, and that we just need government to make sure that we have the environment to get it to market and get it and have our taxpayers benefit from it.
We'll have more with Ted Dixon right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Ted Dixon. Ted, Canadian stocks have been a good geopolitical hedge, with the Inc. Canadian Insider Index up about 10% year to date. What's the story there?
Well, it's mostly energy. Energy has had a nice run. It's benefited from sort of the seasonal side of things. Usually, energy stocks, if they're going to go up, a lot of their gains will be in the beginning of the year. So it's benefited from that. But it's also benefited from exposure to resources in general as commodity prices have firmed here. So, we've got some a little bit of wind behind our backs, and as we talked in the earlier section, I don't see those trends. I don't see those trends reversing anytime soon. But it's always a risk that if the U.S. fiscal situation becomes too unstable, that the global economy, as IMF warned, could be in for a bit of trouble, and that until the Federal Reserve capitulated, that could give us some hiccups. But in general, no, I think the nice thing about the Canadian Insider Index, it's geared towards institutions, so you can kind of see where the institutions would be better off. And right now, the institutions would be better off having a good exposure to Canadian stocks, like the ones that are in the Canadian Insider Index. That's not a security recommendation. That's just a characterization. But I can tell you that a lot of institutions are not yet in Canada, and they're still stuck in chasing technology stocks. And I think that is good news for the Canadian market, because it means we should probably see more institutional money find its way to Canada over the next few months, which should provide more momentum for the Canadian market. Usually, once you get some momentum going, that momentum stays in place. So, not a prediction, but looking forward to hopefully seeing the Canadian market once again. Again, show up on the radar screens of investors. And for example, our index, it is available on the Bloomberg terminal, so institutional investors will see that that this Canadian index is one of the best performing indexes in 2024 in North America, and it'll force some of these institutional investors to start thinking more about Canada. The more money that comes in, because we know our pension funds don't really invest in Canadian stocks anymore. They prefer to invest, in airports in Asia than our own companies. But hopefully we'll get some ambitious institutions who want to outperform and don't hide behind fake private equity numbers to juice their returns. We'll get some institutional money, more money flowing into Canada, I think there's a good chance we'll see that. The Canadian pension fund will be the last to come in, because they've abandoned our public markets for the most part. It's a complete outrage what they've done, and the reason why I say that is because of what they've replaced it with, and they've abandoned our public markets, which are transparent and which you can hold them accountable in terms of their performance, to these private equity obscure investments, which nobody really knows what the performance is. It's all based off of assumptions. But that's a conversation for another day. The Canadian pension funds will be of no assistance to Canadian investors in resource stocks for the time being. We can hope for a sea change there, but that will take years to happen. In the meantime, though, I expect you will find more nimble institutions coming back to Canada, and because we are one of the best jurisdictions, if not the best jurisdiction in the world, for resource stocks and resource names. And there's, it's us or Australia, really. And so we're on the right time zone in that contest. But there's room for both Australia and Canada to benefit here.
The Canadian federal budget was just released, and what caught my eye, increasing the capital gains tax from 50% to 2/3 of your profit. Is that throwing cold water on what could be investments to improve the economy?
Well, it's a headwind. It'll be a headwind for the Canadian market. It's let's not kid ourselves, but it's it is what it is. I think I know what they're trying to do. They're concerned about, I think, some aspects of the economy that were very, like the real estate area, I think is probably going to be more immediately impacted. And maybe that's an issue probably that I'd like to hear from some of your real estate guests that you have on from time to time, what they think. I think that's the more immediate area of concern. But look, this is not helpful to Canadian capital markets in general at all.
In Vietnam, an entrepreneur who was involved in real estate was convicted of a $12 billion fraud and sentenced to death. And now I've heard that's thrown a whole chill over the Vietnamese economy, because anybody who invests and then maybe loses money in that investment might end up in the same place in front of a firing squad. And Vietnam was always billing themselves as an alternative place in Asia to invest from China, where, again, if you commit some kind of financial crime, you might be shot.
Well, I'd like to know how much this Canada pension plan is invested in Vietnam. I don't know off the top of my head, but I'd be interested to know.
Ted, always fun chatting with you.
It's great to be back.
My guest has been Ted Dixon, CEO and co-founder of InkResearch.ca, his website, CanadianInsider.com. If you have any questions for Ted or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on X at How Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.